At that time, Jesus went through the cornfields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry and began to pick some ears of corn and eat them. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath." He answered, "Haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, and he and his companions ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to do, but only for the priests. Or haven't you read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple desecrate the day, and yet are innocent? I tell you that one greater than the temple is here. If you had known what these words mean, 'I desire mercy, not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the innocent. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." Going on from that place, he went into their synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, they asked him, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?" He said to them, "If any of you has a sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will you not take hold of it and lift it out? How much more valuable is a man than a sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." Then he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." So he stretched it out, and it was completely restored, just as sound as the other. But the Pharisees went out and plotted how they might kill Jesus.
A passage open in front of you that Wendy just read to us from Matthew chapter 12. That's where we're going. Religion can destroy people. The film Philomena, which was released just a few weeks ago and which we went to see, portrays the destructive power of religion very vividly. Philomena is the story of an elderly Irish woman of that name, played by Judy Dench in the film, who's in search of her long-lost son. Her son is long-lost because as a teenager, she became pregnant and was sent to a convent to have her baby and to pay the price for her sin. And when the boy was 3 years old, he was taken away by adoptive parents and was never seen again. And now, 50 years on, Philomena is desperate to find him. And the film is the story of her quest. It's essentially a true story, though, as ever, some of the details are exaggerated, changed for dramatic effect. But basically, in its essentials, it's true. And for me, the most powerful scene in the film is where, on this journey, Philomena has returned to the convent and eventually faces the elderly nun who was most responsible for the removal of her son. And the nun still insists that what happened was absolutely right. The young Philomena was rightly punished for her sexual sin, and all the suffering that she has since endured is right, and it's just, and it's entirely her own fault. And Philomena looks down at her in her wheelchair and pronounces the words, "I forgive you." It's terribly difficult for her to do, and it costs her a lot, but she forgives. And as a result, she is set free from the crushing weight of anger and bitterness that she has been carrying. But the nun, who is the most religious person you could possibly imagine, still holds on to the spirit of judgment and condemnation, which has always motivated her treatment of sinful people. You broke the rules, you've been punished. If you want to be close to God, keep the rules and he will look after you. And that is how her life has been lived. That's religion at work. It's destructive. It twists the people who believe it. And it is absolutely opposed to the spirit and teaching of Jesus, as we meet him once again this morning in the pages of Matthew's Gospel. You'll remember, if you've been here, that we've made our way through Matthew 10 and 11, and we're now at the beginning here of chapter 12. Last Sunday, Dave spoke on the final section of chapter 11, where Jesus gives this wonderful, warm invitation. And the last few verses, "Come to me," says Jesus, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Jesus offers himself to us as the ultimate place of rest. He's gentle in heart, as we were sharing last Sunday night, thinking about gentleness. Jesus is the one who cares for his people with such tenderness and peace and love. And as Dave said last week, to find Jesus is to find freedom with the one who took the burden in our place. And today's passage actually comes as a kind of commentary on those last few verses. Jesus says, I will give you rest. And here we meet some people whose religion is anything but restful. Matthew has placed this pair of stories here to explain and expand on those wonderful words of Jesus. It's interesting how he's done that. Mark puts these stories in a different place. He's emphasizing a different point. Matthew places these verses here to open our eyes to the alternative, to the rest that Jesus comes to give. Today, the tentacles of religion still trap so many people. This passage shows us religion in action, and it's an ugly sight. But it also shows us the reality that comes from knowing Jesus. And it's desperately important that we don't confuse them, because one way is a trap, and the other way is freedom. So let's look at these two stories and see what we find. Here's the first story. Jesus and his disciples, for some reason we don't know, are walking from A to B on the Sabbath day. And the Sabbath is the Jewish day of rest, very strictly observed, as we shall see, but it's clearly central to this passage, as it's mentioned no less than 8 times. Verse 1, at that time Jesus went through the cornfields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry and began to pick some ears of corn and eat them. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, look, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath. Okay, what's the problem? No problem with munching on a bit of grain that you pick off as you walk through a field. That's fine, that's okay. It's allowed in the law. It's even spelled out in Deuteronomy 23. The problem is the day. You must not work on the Sabbath day, says the law. True. But who says this is work? We do, say the Pharisees, those earnest promoters of the law of Moses. And at this point, we have to enter what might seem to us like a parallel universe, an alternative dimension. But this is the world inhabited by the Pharisees and people who think like them. Their teachers, keen to define what work means, have drawn up a definition of work in 39 categories. And to their keen legal minds, the disciples here are performing work in at least three ways. They are reaping, that is, they are harvesting the grain as they walk along and pick off the tops of the grain stalks. They are threshing, that is, they are removing the husks so that they can get to the edible kernels inside. And what's more, they are also preparing food. All this on the Sabbath when no work is to be done. So here they come along to challenge Jesus, these Pharisees, because after all, he's the boss and he's the one they really want to get at. In fact, the Jews of Jesus' time went even further than this. The rabbis devoted endless energy to defining what was work and what wasn't work, and whether you were to blame or culpable if you did certain acts on the Sabbath day. There is a whole volume of the compendium of law known as the Talmud, which was written down about 100 years later, that is devoted to just this problem. And it's all online these days. It wasn't at this time, but it is now. And here's an example that caught my eye as I was looking at it this week. I particularly like this one because it involves flower pots. Mishnah 8, the Mishnah is one component of the Talmud. One who plucks something from a perforated flower pot is culpable. From a flower pot that is not perforated, he is not culpable. Rabbi Simeon held him not culpable in both cases. And there's the reference if you want to go and check it out. That is culpable for what you do on the Sabbath. So there you go. Be very careful before you pick anything out of a flower pot if it has a hole in it. unless, that is, you want to go with Rabbi Simeon, who was obviously a little more relaxed than some of the others. And just in case you're wondering, no, the law God gave did not include any of this stuff. Now, we might laugh, we might think this is just bonkers, but the point is this, if you go down the road of religious rules, this is where you end up. Islamic law, the Sharia, is exactly like this, where it's strictly observed. Rules about beards, rules about precisely what you are and aren't allowed to swallow during the Ramadan fast. Are you allowed to swallow a raindrop? What if you swallow it by accident? What if you swallow your own tears? It's all there in the Sharia. It's exactly the same. But closer to home, this kind of religion is what some people think of as Christianity. Follow the right rules. That's what being a Christian is about. And it's not. So how does Jesus respond to the Pharisees' criticism? Well, he gives them three arguments, which we won't dive into in detail. They go into the depths of the Old Testament. It would take us far too long to do all the detail. But we need to understand in outline what he's driving at. So his first argument is in verses 3 and 4. Jesus answered, "Haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, and he and his companions ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to do, but only for the priests." David, on his way to becoming king, takes some of the special consecrated bread from the duty priest in the tabernacle, the center of worship. He's hungry, he needs something to eat, so the priest gives it to him. You can read the story, it's in 1 Samuel chapter 21. But the rules in Leviticus said only the priests could eat this special bread, these 12 large loaves that were set out each week as part of their offerings to the Lord. Yet apparently David's actions were okay. What about that then? Says Jesus. It seems that a basic human need has to take priority over the strictest observance of the law. Argument number two follows in verses 5 and 6. "Oh, haven't you read in the law that on the Sabbath, the priests in the temple desecrate the day and yet are innocent? And I tell you that one greater than the temple is here." The Sabbath rules may be strict, Jesus says, but don't you realize that the priests in the temple are actually commanded in the law to make special sacrifices on every Sabbath day? And yet they can do that and be innocent. So maybe the Sabbath isn't as absolute as you guys make out. And in any case, he casually adds, "Now that I'm here, there's something greater than the temple going on." Argument three is here in verse 7. "If you had known what these words mean, 'I desire mercy, not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the innocent." Now Jesus is quoting the prophet Hosea. Actually, he's already quoted the same line during a similar confrontation back in chapter 9. The meaning of this one-liner is not that God wasn't interested in sacrifices. He had instructed them in great detail about all the sacrifices they were to make. But that the whole exercise is completely pointless if there is no mercy in their hearts. That's precisely the problem that the Pharisees have got. They have missed the mercy which leads them to condemn the innocent. There's that word again. In this case, the disciples, but it could be anyone who doesn't fit their idea about keeping every little last rule. In all of this, Jesus is showing they have missed the point completely. And he concludes with this striking statement in verse 8, "For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." Then we come into the second story. It might be the same day, it might be a different day, but it's certainly a Sabbath. Here's the setting. Verse 9, "Going on from that place, he went into their synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, they asked him, 'Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath?'" So this poor man has a disease which has robbed him of the use of his hands. He's suffering, he probably can't work, so he's in trouble. But it looks from this as if he's been planted in this synagogue congregation by the Pharisees, knowing that Jesus is going to turn up so that they can construct their case against him. Verse 14 confirms it's the Pharisees again. That's who the they are. They want to prove that he is breaking the Sabbath law so that they can, so they set up this man as a test case. Now, why is he a good test case? It's because the law says you can deal with emergencies on the Sabbath, but not routine work. And healing, in their view, is work. But this man is not at death's door. He's not an emergency. He could come back and be healed on Tuesday, say. So, what's Jesus going to do? Well, he turns the spotlight straight back onto his questioners. Verse 11, he said to them, "If any of you has a sheep, and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will you not take hold of it and lift it out? How much more valuable is a man than a sheep? Therefore it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath." What would you do, he said, if your sheep fell in a pit? He's talking about their livelihoods here. The equivalent for us is not your pet cat getting stuck up a tree. It's more like your car driving into a ditch. So it's a major item of property and it's your livelihood. You'd rescue it, wouldn't you? Actually, the rabbis argued about that one as well, but never mind. You know that you would. And here's a man who's worth infinitely more than a sheep. So surely you can see that it's perfectly okay to do this good on the Sabbath. And it's the work of a moment for Jesus to do just that. Verse 13, and he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." So he stretched it out, and it was completely restored, just as sound as the other. But the Pharisees went out and plotted how they might kill Jesus. Great, isn't it? The man is healed. He has his life back. He'll be able to go back to work, support his family, be productive. It's wonderful. It's great. No, it's not great, say the Pharisees. It's not great. In fact, someone like this is highly dangerous. He thinks he can trample all over our hallowed regulations and just get away with it. The Pharisees can see the regulations, but they can't see the point. That's how trapped they are in their religion. It's a classic case of not seeing the wood for the trees. So these stories are a strong warning against that kind of rule-driven religion by which so many people live today, whether they call themselves Muslims or they call themselves Christians or even if they call themselves atheists, because of course that's a religion too. But is this passage all negative? Not at all. If we look again, we can find some really wonderful good news in these stories. First about the Sabbath, and then about Jesus. So first, let's look at the Sabbath, God's gift of rest. The Sabbath is a gift for everyone. Here's the original command. It's number four in the it's number four of the Ten Commandments given at Mount Sinai, 1500 years before the time of Jesus. Exodus 20, verse 8. Remember the Sabbath day. By keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labour and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your animals, nor the alien within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. God gave them the Sabbath as a means of protection for everyone in the community. Men and women, old and young, citizen, and even the foreigners who lived among them. Everyone was protected from having to work on the Sabbath day. It was strictly enforced, yes, but it was a gift, not a burden. Knowing that you are banned from working on that day would actually give you a great sense of freedom. And this idea of Sabbath rest is God's gift for everyone. It's the way we were made. In fact, it recalls God's great act of creation, when he made the universe and then he rested. Though, obviously, rest for God means something very different from rest for us. For one thing, God doesn't get tired. But the pattern is there. A day of respite from work for everybody. And this is what we sometimes call common grace, a gift of God to everyone, whether we're believers or not, to protect us from working ourselves to death or amusing ourselves to death. I'm old enough to remember when the Sabbath was more of a reality in Britain before the Sunday trading laws were relaxed in the 1980s. And then it was decided that, hey, 6 days out of seven wasn't enough for everything to be open. It's got to be open every day. And, you know, that has been to our great loss as a nation. As that intrinsic rhythm of one day of rest in seven has been significantly weakened. Okay, I'm not here to get all nostalgic about the past as if it was some great golden age that we need to recover. It wasn't. But in a culture that has become so reluctant to stop and be quiet for a bit, we still need that downtime, that break from the intensity of life, because it really is a good gift from God. But more than that, the Sabbath is especially a gift for believers. Now, Sunday is not the same as the Sabbath, and it means something a bit different. The Sabbath was the last day of the week, and it looked back to the old creation. Sunday is the first day of the week, the day of Jesus' resurrection, and it looks forward to the new creation which began with his resurrection. The New Testament doesn't call Sunday the Sabbath, but it does call it the Lord's Day. And it is still a gift for us, to give us a day to pause, to reflect, and to worship. So it's not that we come together for an hour on Sunday morning and then that's out of the way. Thank goodness we can rush off and get on with our lives just as frantic as ever. By the way, that's one reason why at Kensington we have this practice of meeting twice on a Sunday. So that the Lord's Day begins and ends with this special focus on Him as we worship together. It's really helpful to bookend the day like that. But whether it's once or twice that we meet, that's not my point. The reason we encourage everyone to be committed to meeting on a Sunday, to making Sunday worship a priority, is not to keep a rule, not because we think God will be more pleased with us if we make it here every week and tick that box. No, it's because this deliberate time to get together and stop and worship and hear God's word is a gift from God. And we want to have the full benefit of the gift. What reason would there be to turn down a gift from God? And if you're saying, no, Steve, you don't understand. You don't know how busy I am. This is ridiculous. I can't possibly afford a day of downtime. Let me ask you. Are you busier than the Israelites who were first called to keep the Sabbath? They were peasants. They were subsistence farmers. Their survival depended on the back-breaking labour they did from first light to dark every single day. Just to survive. And the Lord said to them, trust me by taking a complete break one day in seven. Trust me in this. And I'll provide for you. And he did. And the Sabbath principle is good for us. Because it's how we were made. It's good for our physical and mental health. It's good for our families. It's even good for our work. So if you're a Christian, let me gently challenge you to think about how you use Sunday. Not to construct a whole list of rules, oh, I can't do this, I can't do that, I can't go there, but I can go there. You get back to the world of the Pharisees. No. This is about the attitude of our hearts. And this is about the question, am I going to trust in the Lord to look after me if I just stop being frantic for one day in seven? Now, of course, Sunday itself can't be a day of rest for everyone. For me personally, Sunday can be one of the most demanding days of the week. Other people will be on shift work sometimes on a Sunday, or there are other reasons why Sunday can't be a day of rest. But then we still need to find our Sabbath at another time in the week, whether it's on a Saturday or whenever else I can take time out. I need to stop being so frantic and cramming my life with activities. Believe me, I need to be told that. Many of us do. And this is a gift, not a burden. That's the Sabbath. Now, second, let's look at Jesus, God's ultimate rest. Actually, though it might sound odd to say it, the central focus of this passage is not the Sabbath, it's Jesus. If you read this story through casually, you might get the impression that Jesus is saying something like this. Hang on, guys, lighten up a bit, you're coming on a bit strong. Let's make this Sabbath idea a little bit looser, a little bit easier for people to follow, and then you'll be fine. But in fact, Jesus is saying something much bigger than that. Look back at verse 8. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. It's not just, I've got the authority to ease these fierce regulations a little bit. It's, I'm the one who can show you what observing the Sabbath really means. All through this first story, there are hints at who Jesus really is. In verse 3, he mentions David, who became their greatest king, and who they know is the ancestor of the coming Messiah. And now, here is Jesus, David's greater son. In verse 5, he mentions the temple, which was the focal point of their religion, and which they valued so much. And he says, now something greater than the temple is here. You're looking at it. It's me. Up till now, God has made himself known through the temple and the sacrifices that happened there. Now he's making himself known through me in person. The sacrifices those priests offer, soon they won't need to offer them anymore. Because I am here as the one true and ultimate sacrifice. That laborious and costly work of slaughtering animals and pouring out their blood, that work which continued even on the revered Sabbath day, would shortly be completely superseded as the Son of Man himself, the Lord Jesus Christ, offered himself as the perfect sacrifice on the cross, dying in our place, taking the penalty that we deserve. The Lord Jesus is the greater David, he's the greater temple, and he's the one great sacrifice for our sins, if we'll have him. In this passage, Jesus puts himself forward as the great alternative to religion. Again, look at where we finished last week. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart. And you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. How different from the religion of the Pharisees, which was anything but a rest. In verse 25, just a few lines above, Jesus talks about his teaching being hidden from the wise and the learned. And here are the Pharisees who reckon they are the wise and learned, so wise, and who clearly can't grasp what Jesus is telling them. Come to me and I will give you rest, says Jesus. Come to us and we will make your life a misery, say the Pharisees. A burdensome mass of rules, just like every religion. So what does this mean for us? For Christians, look, your faith is about rest, not a burden. Don't let's fall into thinking that the Christian faith is about keeping the rules. That we're more approved if we keep more of the rules, that we are less approved if we trip up and break some of them, that we get closer to God if we perform better. We do this so easily, just like the nuns in Philomena, and our faith becomes a struggle to perform, a battle to impress God, or a battle to impress other people, or even to impress ourselves. And then it becomes a burden we impose on others as well. Don't we know? Haven't you heard that nothing you can do, no rules you can keep, can make God love you more? And nothing you can do, and no rules that you can break, will make him love you any less. Let's enjoy knowing Jesus and find our rest in him, because we will not find it anywhere else. If you're not a Christian, please don't say this has nothing to do with me. I don't make lists of rules. I don't impose some kind of rigid framework on myself or on anyone else. But can I tell you this? Actually, you do. You've either borrowed your rules from someone else or you've made up your own. And you judge yourself by whether you live up to them. That's what everyone does. Ultimately, those rules, wherever we got them from, are just a cage. Ultimately, that road leads to failure and disillusionment. We can't even live up to our own standards, much less the standards that God Himself has set. Here's the good news for you. Jesus came to let you out of that cage. He's got the key, and He will open the door and let you out. Jesus came to die for you. If you will believe in Him, ask Him to forgive you for all the wrong that you have done, and allow Him to take over running your life. That is what He came for. And He will give you rest. Sabbath is finally just a picture of the permanent rest that Jesus brings. A rest that begins now and goes on into eternity. It's spoken of in Hebrews 4, verses 9 and 10. There remains then a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For anyone who enters God's rest also rests from his own work, just as God did from his. What's that talking about? This is what it's saying. It's saying that once God has given you rest, when you trust in Jesus Christ, you are no longer working to try to win his approval. That desperate struggle to prove yourself is over. What great news that is. Jesus has done the work that we could never do. The work of dying for us. Winning our freedom and our rest. We're going to sing about that now. My hope rests firm on Jesus Christ. When this song talks about hope, it's not some kind of vague optimism. It's a firm and solid confidence that we have in Jesus Christ. My hope rests firm on Jesus Christ. So let's stand and sing.